don't worry, I'm not going to give you a long list of sponsorships and things that you need to buy. Instead, I'm just going to explain. What we do is we teach baking as lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to baking, eating, and sharing bread that improves the gut microbiome and mental health. So let's just get straight into this podcast.
It was going a little bit tight with the water because as every baker knows, you can put more in, but you can't take it out.
I got to write that down.
David, how, while I'm staring, right, you've got to talk about it. Tell me about the acetone, the butyric acid. What's going on at that point where we get all these wonderful sort of changes in the corpus, in a ferment like salad? What's going on biochemically?
Well, when you start seeing like these secondary and tertiary or even quaternary products of fermentation show up in something that's been going for a really long time, it means that you're now entering a succession of metabolites. So things are getting handed off and handed off again, if not reutilized by the organisms themselves. A lot of times people don't really realize this, that is, in the same way that yeast can produce ethanol. First of all, yeast can consume sugar and burn it aerobically. Like, yeast can breathe oxygen just like we do. We like to always talk about them as anaerobic organisms, but they can, if situations warrant it, they can respire like we do.
So, David, can I just stop you there for 1 second? Because then my brain is immediately leaping to mixing sourdough. So I know that I get better yeast development when I mix well and get more oxygen into the dough. So the yeast themselves actually enjoy oxygen to reproduce.
To some degree, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then when it becomes an anaerobic environment, they can switch over, and then you'll get that ethanol production and all the metabolites that are responsible for that. But what's important to note is that even in the presence of oxygen, yeast still prefer to produce ethanol. And that's because it's a defense mechanism. That's because they choose to do it because they're like, well, if I choose to use my or produce my energy this way, I can at least guarantee that no one else is going to bother me.
It's just like
the funny thing.
Moment. It's like I'm doing my own private little thing here and I know no one else is competing with it.
Exactly. Exactly. But they're extremely adaptable organisms. I mean, you think that like these are some of the first complex eukaryotic organisms to ever evolve, and they're still around to this day, and they're extremely fruitful, and they're extremely fecund, and they have worked their ways into our lives in all sorts of manners. And that's because they're adaptable. So you have yeast being able to either breathe oxygen or just ferment sugar in the absence of it. That looks good.
That's kind of, it's kind of getting to that point where it's got that lovely golden color as you're chatting. Just for texture reference, it's still pretty thick. So I'm going to leave it for a couple of minutes and then put a little more water in.
Yeah.
So I get the optimal hydration. So I'm just going to carry on listening for a second. So
what's fascinating about yeast is that even when they run out of sugar, they can go back and then consume the ethanol that they've produced as well. And then live off that. So they are extremely adaptable organisms. And when you start getting into these complex scenarios where you have a microbial community that's really evolved and really run its course, and the substrate or the environment that they're living in has gone through a lot of changes and it's consumed all that's readily available. And now they start up to competing with each other and working other avenues to just stay alive and keep doing what they're doing. All sorts of other different enzymatic pathways get activated. You have to think that like the environment that these microbes are living in act as these genetic switches. It's like, okay, oh, there's no more sugar. I'm not sensing sugar. What's that? I'm sensing a lot of ethanol over there. That means I have a lot of competition. And there's literally like a chain reaction of molecules that like whoop, literally flips on a switch in their DNA and says, okay, start producing this new enzyme now. We have to look for something else. And those enzymes react differently. And these are basically the chemical reactions that writ large are the stress responses of these organisms that then start producing all of these other different chemical compounds. They might start producing a compound that breaks down the residual fats that are in yeast or in wheat, because wheats and grasses do have some amounts of fats in them, right? So they might start breaking those down. They might start interacting with the other microbes in their environment. The acetic acid bacteria that's just in the room, that's the slowest acting of all the microbes that we ferment with, mm-hmm. might start getting in there and consuming the ethanol and then producing acetic acid, which can be hydrolyzed into acetone and all these other nail polishy smells.
So you start seeing
this, like, the complexity grows and grows and grows the longer it sits and the more organisms take part in the picture.
So at the point at which we're acetone, I mean, at that point, I often will describe that the point at which they've really run out of fuel and they started to kind of turn in on whatever else is available. It's a point of starvation. Usually I'm reporting people to the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Sourdough Starters. So I'm like, no, feed your starter. When you get to the butyric acid, you're really at that point, it's gone a little too far. I mean, it's the same as Parmesan and what's between your toes. It's properly stinky. That's sort of almost gone beyond saving at that point for sourdough starter. I almost get people to start again because I'm like, ugh, it's.
That being said, humans are extremely sensitive to butyric acid. I think that we can detect the compound at a threshold of like 3 parts per billion. So just think about that. We're extremely sensitive to it. So
David.
Or feed your sourdough starter. Yes.
Oh yeah. On lockdown, there were two things that I just panic bought. Okay. Olive oil. I didn't panic buy flour because I've got loads here. I had 100 kilos sitting out the back here and I was sharing it. I panic bought olive oil.
I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this. If the idea of prescribing baking as lifestyle medicine as an evidence-based approach to your patients to help them improve their physical and mental health through the bread that they bake, eat and share every day appeals to you, then go to thesourdoughschool.com and learn how you can prescribe or teach this as part of your own practice. If you have just fallen in love with the whole concept and you just want to learn to do this for yourself and your family, you can self-prescribe at thesourdoughclub.com. I look forward to seeing you in some of our live sessions.